Japanese Pioneers Research Project. We're continuing our interview with Hana Yasuda Kangas. Today is February 23rd, 1991. We're interviewing her in her home here in Palmer, and this is take two of a continuing interview. We want to thank you again, Hana, for allowing us to interview you and for the good stories that you've been telling us. I think last time we were talking a bit about your experience at the university. You had gone there, transferred essentially after being out of high school, going quickly to the university, being introduced to Prexy, and being pretty much caught up in all the kinds of activities that college life brings. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you were studying and what kind of profession you wanted to pursue.
At this time, I really didn't know what to study, except behind my thoughts and everything, I always wanted to be a teacher. And I think that stemmed back to my second grade teacher, Miss Jones, who was just a wonderful, made me feel so good being away from home. And this happened in Washington State at Fife School in Fife. And but I never thought I'd become a teacher for personal reasons. I did take business because my father had a business in Beaver, and he had mentioned at one time maybe I could do that. And so I started out as a business major.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like it, so I dropped that end of the semester, and then I took up, I thought I would get out of that school a little bit faster by taking a three-year ed course, and really it didn't work out that well, so finally I took the four-year education.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I finished.
Was that something you enjoyed studying?
Well, yes. I did have troubles the whole year because I kept falling asleep. In class, which was very embarrassing, and I would sleep a good 8 or 10 hours a night, but still I was sleeping during the day. But somebody came to my rescue one day, said that don't worry about it because, it was Mary Jo. She was our dorm woman, and she was teaching English, and I'd fall asleep, and the book sometimes would fall down, and I would really be embarrassed, and so I just felt I had to talk with her, and I did one evening. She said, that's all right. She said, I know. She said, it could be the change of climate. Yeah, you know, I'd just come back to Alaska after 10 years, and she was very nice, and I didn't feel that bad, but I would have this terrible thing of falling asleep if I wasn't real interested with the, you know, but I still would fall asleep.
Was it because the lectures were horribly dull?
I don't know. I think so. I really didn't want to say that because I liked Mary Jo Walker.
Uh-huh.
But because she was so kind and all that, you know, but do you want me to talk about dorm life?
Sure.
And girls, you think that the girls will always be girls, so nice and sweet and everything, but they are just as mischievous as anybody else. And so when they found that I had a friend that would come and turn the lights off because I'd fallen asleep trying to study. And so evidently they knew that I could hardly be awakened because they would play some kind of a trick on me. They would, about three or four of them would come and pick up the mattress, and I'd be on the, you know, sleeping, and they would put me out in the hallway, and Mary Jo, Miss Walker, would come upstairs and see what all that commotion was, you know, but she could never find anybody but me sleeping. And I could almost know that things were happening, but I could not wake up completely. It was just terrible. So that was my first year at college. But I was awake on the in the gym floor because I just liked that so much. So that's where I kept awake, and I think I was so active that maybe it just caught up with me during class time or in, at night when I should be doing my studies too.
So you were really active, though. You were playing basketball? And...
Hardly anybody remembers me as a good student. But they always remember about, oh, basketball, you know, oh, baseball.
And I heard that you were a very good typist, too, for the yearbook.
I did some typing, but no, what was good was that I went to Fairbanks and collected a lot of money from the business people. And I did collect quite a bit. They even told me to quit collecting.
And that was for the yearbook?
Yes. Don't you know in yearbook they had advertisements in the back of the book, and I sold out at these things. And Weisslein was on it, too, at that time, and John Roche.
Tell us about the living accommodations on campus. What were the dorms, and were there separate dorms for women, or were they?
There were two dorms when I went there, and one was a women's dorm. It was above the kitchen. We could almost tell what we were going to eat. And then some distance away, not too far away, was the men's dorm. And I was still out there when they had another building across, just across the road that had a few dorms in it and some, and a post office in the basement or in the first floor.
So how many students were there total when you were there?
Oh dear, there were not many. Let me see, I would say maybe 30 women.
And twice as many men?
Well, more than that. They were all coming up here from mining. I understand. A lot of them were in mining, you know. And evidently, University of Alaska School of Mines had a good name. And these men could have jobs in the summer with the FE company there. You know, that's why it helped a lot. And of course, we had the bus service coming in from Fairbanks, and we had city students.
Oh, who would commute then out on the bus? Were you there when the train was used and made a stop there at college?
Oh yes. Oh yes. We would meet the basketball players from. Anchorage, coming to play basketball, and all different events, you know.
So what year did you start at the university?
I started in 1934, and I graduated in 1940. So it took me a number of years, but I had changed from one, what do you call that?
Major?
One major to another. And I went home for Christmas when a fur buyer had called me, said he was going over there to buy some furs and that I could come along, mm-hmm. have a free ride for Christmas. So I went, and I missed. We were snowbound, and I missed the tests.
Oh.
I couldn't. I could have taken the test, but I didn't want to. In those years, I didn't even know that it was held against you because they did give you a failing mark
mm-hmm.
if you didn't, you know. I understand they don't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then another time, I lost as many credits when I took the job of taking the census. 1939.
Uh-huh.
So I lost that too. But
now that's the census that you wrote about in the Alaska Magazine article.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, those were very rich experiences, though.
I know. I think if I had to do that over again, I would do it again. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I would go to Beaver with that fur buyer because I did not know that at that time that he wanted to get the furs that my father had in trading.
Oh.
And I think that was his idea, that if he took me over there, that my dad would be kind to him. But because my dad never said anything, I asked him once, and he said he didn't like it that I came over with him. And nobody sold their furs to him anyway, so I think he was trying to find a way to be friendly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you remember any particular faculty members or other people in Fairbanks who were helpful or an inspiration?
Sure, I remember Dr. Ryan very well.
Mm-hmm. What about him that impressed you?
Well, now that I'm, well, I used to tell my children about this, but I never, you know, told anybody because I don't know why. I thought maybe it would be bragging or thing, but Dr. Ryan said that he had, he thought that I was a very good athlete, that whatever I did, that I would just like I had already known it, you know, and so he made me, and I kind of think it was truthful because that type of things came very easy to me, you know, whereas maybe history and things didn't do that well for a while after I found out that I better get busy with history and English and all those subjects, then it became like, you better get with it, you know. But all my years, I did a lot of athletics there. In fact, Dr. Ryan let me have his two classes, and I taught those two classes, PE classes, because they had no more subjects for me to take.
So you became the teacher.
Yes, and got credit for that.
Uh-huh.
And not only that, he became a superintendent of schools in Fairbanks. And one day at church, he asked me to become one of the teachers there.
Yeah.
And I felt really great about that, but I decided not to.
And why is that?
It was because I was at that time staying with a friend for a couple of weeks, and she was a secretary of the PTA. And if you know a little bit about Fairbanks, there were not very many Native peoples there. They were all Caucasians, and I felt like I couldn't face it because one day she came back from a meeting and said, "Oh, they're all on the teachers again," and she felt really badly about them because she knew some of the teachers. She knew her daughter's teacher and thought that she was a good teacher and all, but for some reason there were on the teachers again, and I didn't quite understand that, except it didn't sound good, so I didn't take that job. But somebody else knew that I had wanted to be a teacher, and I got a wire from Nome, and I thought, oh, that'd be a safe place to go, because mm-hmm. there would be quite a few Eskimos there. And so I started teaching in Nome.
Nome, uh-huh. So that would have been right after you graduated in 40 then?
Oh, no, that was way after, because it was like in 51.
51.
Yes, mm-hmm. because in those years, after graduating, I went to Beaver.
Oh, okay.
And became the postmaster and helped with the store.
Before we get to your return to Beaver, can you tell me who were the first Native graduates of the U of A, male and female?
I know there was an Arthur Nagazaruk that Dr. Bunnell sent a picture of him to my father, and I remember seeing his picture, and he was teaching off in the coast someplace.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the name because not too long ago I saw his picture in the Tundra Times, and it told about his life.
Uh-huh.
So I remember that. And then I don't know about Tim Twitchell graduated before I did. I think he was a UPIC. And then Flora Harper graduated before. She was a senior when I was a freshman there. Flora Harper.
From where?
She's from Fairbanks. Her, let me see now, I think her grandfather could be with the, I never met her father, so I don't know, but in the early Alaskan days, you know that there were these four men, Mayo, McQuestion, Harper, and, oh, I've forgotten the other name, were very prominent
right.
in interior Alaska.
Right.
Yeah, so she was from that Harper family.
Oh, I see.
And she had a brother named Francis that I went to school with. And Laura is now living stateside. She was a librarian for many years in Anchorage.
Oh.
Librarian.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many Native students were there at the university while you were there?
When I was there, Tim was finishing, Flora was finishing, and there was an Amy Riley from Mountain Village. And Gladys Hall from Bethel.
Hmm. Was there any feeling of commonality amongst those Native students? They were from all over.
We just fit in. It was just nice. Everything was nice about being there.
Mm-hmm.
There was one other, and I can't remember her name. I think she was part Russian.
That sounds like it was a nice environment, fairly small, and everyone knew everyone, too.
Yes, it was very small compared to now. Everything is big now, and everything is just like you can be lost.
Did you have to make any adjustments, either physically besides sleeping differences, from Washington when you came back to Alaska?
Well, besides sleeping, I ate, and I gained. I gained about 20 pounds.
You were just getting ready for the winter time, that's all.
It was already winter and I was forever gaining.
Were there any other things that were sort of different in the way you did things or thought about things?
No. You'd have to ask me specific questions because there's so many things that.
Okay. I was thinking about things like diet or the
diet. We had a lot of, I think, a lot of starches, I heard.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We always had potatoes. At the farm out there grew a lot of things for the school then, you know. So
they were heavy on whatever was produced.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to hear one that kind of threw me a little bit? It was coming from Washington, the people I lived with there had some chickens, and so we had fresh eggs all the time. But when I went to live in this dorm in college, I could smell this thing, but didn't know what it was. When we went down there, you almost had to turn around and go back upstairs. And I found out there were eggs. And it's just unbelievable. So when I went home for the summer, we had the same kind of eggs there, you know. But through the years, I got to eat them and like them. And when they started air freighting the eggs, and we had these watery tasting eggs, there was absolutely no taste in them. It was just like the first time, except was just turned around.
I guess they do get ripe when they're being held there for a long time.
They were called boat eggs, I think.
Uh-huh.
I remember my dad said, "We have to turn these eggs around again. They're always turning them around so they wouldn't be set," I guess, you know.
Oh, so the yolks wouldn't set.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the time then once you left Fairbanks. You went back to Beaver to help with the post office and the store?
Well, before I finished school, I got married.
Mm.
And so then I wanted to go home. This was after the taking the census. So I went home in latter part of 1940.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband went with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived there until about 1949.
Mm-hmm.
And I left.
Uh-huh. And who was he?
His name was Noel Ross, and he was with the newspaper. He was a reporter,
oh.
And he took pictures.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. He was with which paper?
Lathrop's paper.
Lathrop's, oh. So while you were in Beaver then, you were helping out with lots of things, probably.
Well, trying to. Learning new things, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's at approximately the time that your dad was gone.
Yes.
Is that part of the reason that you were there helping, too?
That was great. A great, you know, it was around those years, though, but I had been wanting to go home,
mm-hmm.
to be with, you know, I hadn't been with my parents except in the summertime while I was going to school, and I hadn't been home for 10 years. So I wanted to go home and be with them, be close, you know, to them, and so we went over there.
Mm-hmm. Since we're approximately at the time that the war broke out, can you talk about the evacuation and how that affected your father and then subsequently the family?
Well, what I can remember, this one time a float plane came. We'd already heard about the war. And a float plane came, the army float plane, and these uniformed people came up the gangplank and I became a little nervous, you know, because I wondered what was going to happen. So I went to the couple that were walking up first, and they said, you know where Frank Isuda lives? I said, yes. And so I took them over to my dad's house. Dad was lying down reading, and when I went in, he just got up. He was fully dressed. He was lying reading. And I said, these men are here to see you. And so I stayed, and they all sat around this table. And I really didn't know. I was kind of scared, but Dad was very friendly. And they came to find out what kind of clothing the army people should wear. And I don't know who said to go see Frank Isuda, but that's what they were there for. They were from the Lead Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember them saying, Stephenson said, there's nothing like caribou. And I remember my father saying, that would be the worst thing. And so they asked him, what would be good? He said, woolens and down. And so they wanted to know more about the caribou. And Dad said, you'll have to have a bunch of women following you so they can fix the furs to be worn again, because if they, any body perspiration on it when they hang them up to dry would become stiff as a board, that somebody would have to scrape them or work them with their hands to soften them up. And he said, not only that, the caribou hair is very, it just breaks off. It doesn't come off the hide itself. It just breaks. And that would be in the guns and in whatever, you know, even in the airplanes, whatever. It's very dangerous to have that around. And so Dad, as he talked and answered questions, he made coffee for them, and he sliced some fresh bread, and they ate, and they had a good visit. And, well, when they started to eat, I didn't even help Dad, because he was so good about serving anyway, so I just left, and I just had to get some fresh air and say that I felt real good about it, you know, that it wasn't frightening.
Mm-hmm.
But then some days, it wasn't too long after that, somebody came, and I can't remember who came, and I can't remember the pilot, but he said that we're going to come back and take you over to Fairbanks, Frank. And he said, he said, okay. And he said, this man said that Jack Buckley wants to come over to get you. Jack Buckley was a marshal, and Jack Buckley was a good friend of my father's. And he said, nobody goes to get him but me. So we felt good about that. So Jack Buckley came and took him to him. We didn't say much of anything. It was just like a big shock, so we didn't talk about it for a long time. And I didn't remember. I don't know the Eskimo language very well when the adults are talking, but I know that when women would come over and sit with my mother and talk, they must have said something, you know, because it would be kind of solemn, but I would not understand what it was, and I couldn't ask them what they were talking about.
When those military men came the first time to ask the questions, do you think they were really interested in knowing about the furs and the clothing, or were they to check out your father and maybe Oshima and the other folks.
No, I really think they wanted to know about the clothing. Oh. Yeah, I really did, because they hadn't even started making things, and I understand they had a big group of women with these big machines. I've never seen them, but they could sew like jackets and things like that, parkies and stuff like that, with down filling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just heard about them.
And they were doing that in Fairbanks?
Yes.
Now, what about Oshima and the other people in Beaver?
Now, you know, when you first asked the question about, I was trying to think, did he go first or did he go after? And I think he went first. I'm not sure, though, George Oshima, but he died in the hospital. I think it was stateside sometimes. He became ill. Mm-hmm. He was a fragile man. Strong, mm-hmm. but yet fragile, you know. You understand what I meant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was during the evacuation period then that he died in a hospital outside?
After transferring him from here to there, wherever, you know, then he became ill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I think you'd mentioned earlier that he had a great interest in financial matters, or used to read the Wall Street Journal. Did he actually have a great fortune someplace?
We don't know. We just know. My dad has said that. I wonder what happened to all of his, holdings, whatever they were. Like he had, he was interested in Borden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Alaska. A.J. Mine and Juno.
Oh.
I know there were several others, but I can't tell you now what they were. But he didn't care about the New York Times paper at all, except that section that had that in the stock exchange, I guess, or whatever. So he would take that out and give a paper to whoever wanted the paper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, did he have any obvious family or other people who he communicated with or would have passed things on to?
No. He just seemed to be by himself. Oh. All the time we were there, all the time he lived in Beaver. Someone told me, though, that there's an island called Oshima in Japan, is there?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That maybe he came from that island.
There are two different separate islands with the same name, Oshima, and right under Tokyo, another Oshima, mm-hmm. close to the southern end.
Well, I know he and my dad were good mathematicians when I would try to figure out how to do the quarterly reports of the post office. I was having great problems, and I could just hear my father say, "Can't you see? This is," and and he would say, "Maybe George could help you." But in Beaver, in those early years, you know, hardly anybody knew how to read, even the Caucasians.
Hmm.
Victor and Olaf read, but they read a lot of adventure stories, plus hunting stories, and plus the detective stories.
Oh.
And I wrote letters for some of those people that didn't know how to write.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my dad made orders for the families that wanted to order Sears and Roebuck.
Mm-hmm.
Or help them with it somehow, you know.
So you were then helping with the store and with the post office during that?
Mm-hmm.
That period. Mm-hmm. What kinds of things would come into the store?
Oh, just the very things that people needed. We hardly had any candy, except Dad would get candy for Christmas and he would store them away so nobody knew where they were. They came in big, like big kegs, box made out of wood, you know. And there would be like Christmas candies and things like that. And of course, in those early years, we had no pop. And we never did sell pop. I don't know why, but we never did. We had such things as flour and sugar, butter, canned butter, Crisco, and rice and macaroni, some cheese, eggs.
Those boat eggs.
Boat eggs. And fruit. Many kinds of fruit would come, but we would just have it for that time, like apples and oranges. Or apples and oranges came more often, but grapes and melons. My dad was great on melons for some reason. He liked melons, so we had melons. But he got them for... many times for the children to see what they were. Take them back to school. They would eat melons.
Now, the orders would get filled where?
In Seattle.
In Seattle. So everything would come up by true boat. Now, did you deal with fabrics or anything
like
that?
Oh, yes. And bolts of fabric. Bolts of colorful ones and all the colors, you know. And but this one time I remember, I think I've told you this, that my mother, being Eskimo, would do her Eskimo cultural thing. She'd bring two or three women over and they would look at what they needed there, you know, and they would take them home. They would be the colorful materials. And after they were just about all gone, my dad would say, look what I have left, all the blacks and the browns. All the grays, blacks, and browns are left. But he said, that's all right, that's for your mother.
What kinds of things came into the post office, and how often did you get delivery?
We had so many things come to the post office from Sears Roebuck, from Montgomery Ward, a lot of magazines. People read a lot, you know, even though, well, what I would say, Paul Schultz read. He had good background education. I think he came from Europe in the early years. And then there was another Schultz, Charlie Schultz from Michigan, who didn't know how to read, but he was the postmaster in name only. When my dad helped him to remember how to write his name, because there were papers that had to have his name on it, you know. And but Dad would do all the necessary things, like doing quarterly reports, which were so foreign to me. I don't think I could do them today. But it was very funny too, because this would only happen in the summer. In the winter, I'd be in school, but in the summertime, he would say, I have to go out and do some buying now, and I want you to take care of this post office. Well, he'd already had trouble with the way I did it, and you have to be really very careful when you're working for the government, especially the post office, you know, maybe other places too, but I just know about the post office. He says, get this right, and he would tell me what to do. Well, the first summer, I guess it didn't go quite right. Second summer was about the same. We had a man named George Starr in Seattle who was the head of the post offices in Alaska. And he would make a trip now and then. He'd come up, and I remember he looked at this. You don't do it like this. You're supposed to. And so I said, well, my father will come back and he'll. And so one summer, I think my dad gave up, and he said, he put money in the safe box, and he said, this is the money for the post office. If you have trouble, just say, we own the post office and here's the money. And so I thought that was really good, but it was not good because George Starr said, you don't do it like this either. So I think my dad was a little bit upset that I didn't do that part right, but because at one time when I wouldn't be reading, but somebody would read something for me and I would just mimic it right back, and he said, boy, I have a prodigy here, but probably didn't turn out the way he wanted to. But I finished college because of him. I didn't, because he was so pro-education. In fact, he built the first school in Beaver by himself, and got Dr. Bunnell to see if he can get a teacher.
Oh. Now, under what system was that school started?
That was
started?
BIA. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What year would that have been?
Oh, dear. Must have been around 1927. Uh-huh. Because I think my sister came back home in 1928. She was going to school stateside, too. And I think she came home in 1928. And she was there when this one teacher decided not to finish the school out, and my sister Bernice
took over the classes. And,
but she never continued in her education because she met a friend in Fort Yukon, and it was really a lot of fun in those years because there was not that much drinking, there was no dope around, you know, and it was just everything was kind of safe. Mm-hmm. We didn't know this, you know, we didn't even know how safe it used to be, but when you look back now, like when I go on a trip, my friends would say, don't go out, no, we have to be with you, you know, and so I still don't quite understand that because here we are in Palmer, we feel very safe.
Right.
And in those years too, now my daughter does not let her young, when they were small, go running around anywhere because it was not that safe, you know, in the bigger places, but she remembers the days in Valdez and Bethel where if they didn't come home within the hour, we still would not be worried. They'd come home anyway, and they would be delayed playing a game or something, you know. And we never worried about them.
Mm-hmm. Those changes certainly are very pronounced now.
Isn't that right?
It's very difficult, I think, to raise a child or to be part of that. You mentioned earlier something about Herrlichka and Beaver.
I have never met him, but I heard a friend and my mother talking and laughing about this, this man that would come and measure heads. Uh-huh. So that's how I knew that he'd been there not too long before I got there. He had been through there.
So that would have been in the 30s sometime?
Oh no, it would be even before that, I think. Wouldn't it be before that? I came up in 34.
Okay, so the late 20s then.
Because it was either reminiscing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to take a quick break here while I flip the tape over.
Okay.